In the matter of State versus Jose Carrion, may we please have appearances of counsel? Mr. Flynn, go ahead first.
Good morning, Your Honor. John Flynn, Assistant Deputy Public Defender for Mr. Carrion.
Good morning, Your Honor. William Munoz with Whipple Lazzarello, appearing on behalf of Amicus ACDLNJ.
Barbara Rosenkrantz for the State.
Welcome, counsel. Mr. Flynn, this is the first time we're doing a hybrid with in-person and virtual. We will see how it goes. You let us know if you have any problems hearing or communicating with us during the argument by just signaling in some fashion. Mr. Flynn, please go ahead.
Thank you, Chief. I respectfully request 2 minutes for rebuttal if necessary.
That's fine.
May I please the court? There are two issues before the court today, a Miranda issue and a Confrontation Clause issue. I'd like to begin with the Miranda issue and then transition to the Confrontation Clause issue. In State v. O'Neill, this court embraced New Jersey's rich history of scrupulously honoring defendants' rights against self-incrimination, providing defendants with the critical and essential information needed to make a knowing and intelligent waiver of that right, and discouraging police from making end runs around Miranda. Today, I am asking this court to reject the state's invitation to dilute this important O'Neill doctrine by entirely eliminating consideration of whether the police provided a suspect with a retrospective warning that their previously unwarned statement cannot be used against them. Instead, this court should either reaffirm the importance of this factor under the traditional O'Neill test, or adopt one of the proposals of the ACDL, including the proposal that the failure to provide this retrospective warning renders a second statement in a two-stage interrogation presumptively inadmissible. And in this case, this court should suppress Mr. Carrion's second statement because the state failed to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the warnings given before the second interrogation functioned effectively in providing the defendant with the ability to exercise his state law privilege against self-incrimination. I'd like to begin with the rule that was established in O'Neill and the rationale behind it. In O'Neill, this court relied on our state law privilege against self-incrimination to both avoid the confusion that had been set under State v. Siebert of what was the governing standard under federal law for two-stage interrogations, and to also avoid the problem of needing to delve into the subjective intent of police officers during two-stage interrogations. I also did not request an open statement as well. So this court discussed this court's rich history of providing greater rights to defendants under our state constitution and our common law privilege against self-incrimination and under the Fifth Amendment, discussing cases like Reed and AGD, and said that as in Reed and AGD, we must set clear standards that will discourage law enforcement agencies from engaging in conduct that will deny defendants a true opportunity to assert his right against self-incrimination. And in this case, what the police did are exactly the sorts of tactics that make it harder for a defendant to knowingly, intelligently, and voluntarily waive and exercise his right against self-incrimination. In this case, the officers unquestionably violated Miranda when arresting defendant in his home without giving any Miranda warnings at all. They told Mr. Carrion that his wife would be arrested and his children taken by Dyson unless he admitted that the contraband that the police had found in this black bag was his. And Mr. Carrion did, in fact, admit to possession of the bag under those threats. After he was transported to the police station and presumably remained in a holding cell for 6 hours, he was questioned by another detective from the same police force, both about the drugs that were recovered and about his involvement in the shooting incident that he was under arrest for. The police never gave a retrospective warning or did anything at all to dispel the notion that this previous threat that his children would be removed unless he confessed was in fact not true, or that his children weren't going to be removed. Mr. Carrion continued to admit and the guns were covered in the black bag were his, believing that the cat was out of the bag after that. But consistent with the belief that the cat was out of the bag, he denied culpability in the shooting. He denied that he was dealing drugs, and was clearly operating under the impression that his earlier statement was in, that it was out of the bag and there was nothing he could do. There was no point in remaining silent and refusing to incriminate himself with respect to that. And of course, the officer did not give any retrospective warning. So I think when analyzed under the traditional O'Neill factors, all five, and giving appropriate weight, as the O'Neill court said, great weight to the retrospective warning factor, there's no way to say that the state proved beyond a reasonable doubt that these later warnings functioned effectively in providing Mr. Carrion with the information needed to knowingly, intelligently waive his Miranda rights and re-incriminate himself. The problem with the appellate division's opinion is that while they purported to apply the O'Neill factors to the factual findings made by the trial court, they did so kind of in the wrong manner. So for one, they completely omitted the fact that the retrospective warning is supposed to be given straight weight. They also omitted discussion of the beyond reasonable doubt standard. And they also didn't mention any of the laudatory language in O'Neill about how the problem with two-stage interrogations is that often end run around Miranda. It's a way of kind of hiding the ball from a suspect, and that we should be on high alert in two-stage interrogations that the police might not be doing the right thing. It might not be providing defendants with all the information needed. And they're creating an atmosphere that's going to be harder to prove to later waiver. The appellate division didn't cite any of that. They didn't cite it beyond the reasonable doubt standard. They actually cited State v. Gonzalez, which is a Fourth Amendment suppression case where the standard of review as to the suppression motion. And then came to the conclusion that four of the O'Neill factors weighed in favor of admission, and that even though this all-important retrospective warning factor was missing, the scales tipped in favor of admission. So that could be a figure of speech, but it could also be a critical misapprehension of the nature of the O'Neill test. And this court's and this state's important distinction where we have to prove that the waiver was knowing, voluntary, and intelligent beyond reasonable doubt. And those are important features of our law that in O'Neill and other contexts make us higher than the federal floor. So when we don't adhere to those tenets of O'Neill and tenets of our case law, the way that the appellate division applied the test also gets closer to being violative of federal law. So I'd like to also now turn to the specific five O'Neill factor and kind of discuss some of the errors that the appellate division made in weighing the other four.
Mr. Flynn, I'd like you to try to do that succinctly so that we can move on soon to the second issue.
Okay. So the first factor, the extending question of the nature of any admission, the appellate division and the trial court essentially seemed to say that the first questioning was free. But I think what's important under the first factor, and as I tried to make clear in my brief, that this was a threat as well. So the nature of that question and the fact that no Miranda warnings were given at all, I think actually makes factor one weigh heavily in favor of suppressing the statement. Because this isn't a case like Youngson where it was a technical error in the Miranda warnings and nothing incriminating was produced. This was a directly incriminating statement in response to a threat. As to the second, third, and fifth factors, which have to do with the proximity and time and place, and whether the same law enforcement conducted the interrogation and the degree to which the interrogation is a continuation, they seem to reason that because 6 hours had elapsed, it was a different time, and the officer testified that he hadn't spoken to the arresting officers or wasn't involved in the underlying shooting investigation. And I think those factors were just analyzed from the wrong perspective. They need to be analyzed from the perspective of the reasonable person in defendant's position and not based on the subjective knowledge of the police officer. So this, Sieber uses the phrase a new and distinct experience. O'Neill says substantial change in circumstances. And I submit that remaining in a holding cell for 6 hours and then being questioned by a number of the same law enforcement about the same crimes doesn't make this a new and distinct experience from a defendant's perspective. Moreover, as to the detective Johnson's testimony that he wasn't involved in the investigation, he did, first of all, nothing to communicate that to the defendant. It wasn't like he told Mr. Carrion that I'm totally uninvolved in this investigation and have no idea what's going on, so you're on a clean slate. There was nothing from the transcript of the interrogation that would give the defendant the impression. And moreover, in a variety of contexts, including in the Miranda context, courts impute knowledge of what one officer does to another officer. So, for example, in the context of an Edwards violation in Arizona v. Roberson, the Supreme Court of the United States held that it doesn't matter whether the request for counsel was made to one officer and then a different officer is the one who reinitiates interrogation. The rule has to apply that officer, the first officer's knowledge that the defendant requested counsel appeared to the second, because we need to encourage police procedures that enable an officer who proposes to initiate an interrogation to determine whether the suspect has previously requested counsel. In State v. Reed, about requesting whether that making a defendant aware that an attorney is present to consult with him. Again, it doesn't have to be to the interrogating officer. The attorney doesn't have to tell it. You just have to tell it to a member of the police force who can reasonably communicate with your interrogating officer. So in this context, too, I submit it would be entirely appropriate to impute knowledge that the police elicited an unwarranted statement during a first interrogation to a second officer from the same police force who is doing the second interrogation, even if he testifies that he didn't actually know about it. And then finally, the other O'Neill factor speaks for itself. It's the retrospective warning, and I do submit that that should be given great weight to you. So unless the court has any further questions as to this issue, I'll transition to the Confrontation Clause issue.
Please do.
So as to the Confrontation Clause issue, this affidavit signed by a state police officer attesting that my client, that a search of the public records revealed that there was no record of a handgun permit for my client, was clearly testimonial under established Supreme Court precedent because it was created for the primary purpose of criminal prosecution against this defendant. I think the briefing makes really clear that Melinda and Diaz discussed this type of absence of a public record exception in this decision. And, its reasoning was essential to upholding in Melendez-Diaz and following Melendez-Diaz and the court to consider the issue of the absence of a public document as how that such records are subject to confrontation. The only case in
Counsel, how to reconcile that with 803C10 and 902K?
So I haven't raised the issue of whether this complied with the rules of evidence. But even if it, assuming for the sake of argument, that
I'm sorry, counsel, I missed what you said. I haven't reconciled, and that was all I heard in that sentence. If you could repeat what you said.
I didn't specifically, at least in this court, raise the issue of whether this affidavit complied with the rules of evidence. But even assuming for the sake of argument that. Admission without any testimony.
Well, there's no counselor. There's no argument. 803C10 says the record or statement does not exist. It's admissible, and 807 says a writing asserting the absence of an official record authenticating the manner prescribed for public documents, which this was, in paragraph A, B, or C of this rule, is admissible. Not an admissible hearsay.
Yes, Your Honor, but even if a document is admissible under state rules of evidence, the second stage of the confrontation clause analysis is whether the document is testimonial. And this document was testimonial because it was created for the primary purpose of being used against Mr. Carrion.
The rules don't distinguish between testimony or non-testimony. So it's admissible. Obviously, if it's admissible in court, it's testimonial. That's why it's used. Now, for surpluses, so how does your argument reconcile with those two rules, or State versus Rogers, appellate division case?
So, Rogers, as to the confrontation clause issue, was relying on the now defunct analysis that reliable documents written under state evidence rules don't offend the confrontation clause. But following Crawford, The test is whether document is testimonial. When the document is testimonial, even if it's admissible under state evidence rule, it is subject to confrontation. So in this case,
that's contrary to Roger's holding, counsel.
Well, again, Rogers predates Crawford by nearly 20 years. It's defunct. It's no longer good law.
Counsel, you're suggesting that even if it abides by the rule itself, there may be a constitutional issue.
That's correct.
So, Mr. Flynn, can you tell us precisely the language of the affidavit? Do you have the affidavit?
I actually don't. The affidavit was not made part of this record. But
That's really problematic. I was looking for it in one of the appendices. I didn't see it anywhere. Am I missing it? Is it somewhere in the appendix of our court or the appellate division?
It is actually described in a lot of detail on the February 2nd, 2017 trial transcript, which is also where the defendant's statement is transcribed. And I'm sorry, I'm just pulling it up now. It is on I'm looking at the wrong transcript. It's actually the February 1st transcript where this is transcribed.
Is there a reason why it's not in the record itself? There's no confidentiality issue that attaches to something like that, is there?
No, there's not. It should have been placed in the appellate division appendix. I was not representing defendant.
Can you break down for us what part of the affidavit presents a confrontation clause issue? Because there are at least two pieces to it. First is the existence of the database itself. That's not testimonial. Would you agree?
The existence of a document.
The data in the database, the listing of individuals as to whom there is a permit, you're not suggesting that that database alone is testimonial, are you?
No, that's correct. The database itself, so, a document saying someone had a permit or submitted an application for a permit, those documents wouldn't be testimonial.
Is it where the witness says, I checked the database and this person's name is not in it? Is that the testimonial piece that you are troubled with?
Exactly. Yes, Your Honor.
One of the reasons why I was asking you, Mr. Flynn, what's in the affidavit? I'm interested to know whether or not the affidavit indicates what database was used. And precisely what information was inputted? Was the date of birth, all of the information that would assure the identification of the defendant? Is that, and I'm not just talking about whether or not it said, oh yeah, we put in the date of birth and the Social Security number. Was the actual date of birth, was the actual Social Security number? So that they were, go ahead.
I'm sorry, Ryan. So it was actually, this is in the February 2nd, 2017 transcript on page 40, and the prosecutor describes what the affidavit says. He says, it appears that the state of New Jersey letterhead office of the Attorney General has a seal on the top, explains it's an affidavit, Brett C. Bloom, and it says that he searched the records and that he was not able to find any record of defendant having made application for being issued any of the permits to carry a handgun, purchase a handgun, or a firearms purchaser identified card. He signed the document, notarized by someone else, and has a raised seal. So, it doesn't, at least to my knowledge, specifically you could say it has defendant's Social Security number, what exactly.
The reason why I'm asking that question is because the opportunity to cross-examine a witness can elicit potential mistakes that could be made when someone's searching a database. If we know what database is even being searched, that's one of the questions they're asking you. What database are we talking about? And how many databases are there? And what information is inputted? And whether or not that information is even in the affidavit? And whether or not that's the type of information that is testimonial in nature that would be explored on cross. Go ahead.
Right, and I mean, in Hextrap, we kind of spelled out a little bit more, too, and for that discussion to later, but we, you know, sometimes we carry that in there. This appears to be a state data agreement. But the focus in the confrontation clause, line of cases following Crawford, is not only so much about the, really at all, about the reliability of the information, it's about the method by which it's tested, and that's through cross-examination. And it's the creation of this affidavit itself. By Brett Siegmund saying that he did this, that is the creation of a document that's solely for the purpose of being used against the defendant. What's essential is that it occurs after the defendant has been charged with the crime. So, there's cases following Mendez Diaz that say, you know, a notice of a driver's license suspension that's mailed in the regular course to people is not testimonial because that occurs prior to the defendant being charged with the crime. In fact, you almost like give them notice not to commit a crime. So documents like that aren't testimonial. But a document like this.
Counsel, I want to try to narrow the area of disagreement here, and let me ask it this way. Suppose this database could be put on a laptop. You've already told us the database itself is non-testimonial, so it doesn't invoke any Crawford issues. Could the jury be asked to do a word search, a name search on the database?
I guess in theory that would not offend the confrontation clause. I'm trying to think about whether there's, you know, like an evidentiary exception that would allow admission of the database itself, like there is a like an out-of-court statement being used to prove the truth. So I would have to think a little bit.
The database would come in under hearsay exception, as we covered a little bit earlier. Let's simplify it. Suppose the database consisted of 100 names, and it could be printed on a sheet of paper and presented. And the jury then asked, have a look at the 100 names and see if this defendant's name is on it. Any confrontation clause violation?
You got this. I don't think so, because the underlying database wasn't created for, at least under your hypothetical, wasn't created specifically for the purpose of.
Right. And if defense counsel wanted to pose the questions that Justice Albin offered a little bit earlier, they could call. They could subpoena and call someone to present that testimony. The defense has that subpoena power, doesn't it?
It does. Yes, Your Honor.
So the core of the problem here that you're advancing is the witness said, I looked and I didn't find the name. That has to be presented in the form of a witness. That's essentially your argument, correct?
That's correct, Chief Justice.
And I'm also assuming that your argument is the right to produce witnesses is not a cure to the right of confrontation.
Right, exactly. And similarly, just because there might be other methods of admitting this sort of evidence that were close to what they're done here that might not cross the line of impermissible, you know, under the confrontation clause. What happened here was, because this affidavit was unquestionably created in the first instance solely to be used in the criminal prosecution against defendants. And I just need to reiterate that following Melendez Diaz, every court that has dealt with this type of certificate has found that it's subject.
Counsel, why would an affidavit be prepared beforehand when no one knows what the charges are, what's going to come up? The affidavit is prepared under the rules of evidence in order to provide it, and it's admissible and doesn't require testimony. Why would an affidavit be prepared beforehand for the 9.5 million citizens that state has? Are you suggesting that they should have an affidavit as to each and every one of us so they can use it and then it's not prepared for litigation? Is that your position?
No, Justice. I'm not suggesting that that's the most practical way to get around this confrontation requirement, but Crawford says what it says, Davis says what it says about the primary purpose test, and under federal confrontation standards, this document was created solely for the purpose.
Yeah, Mr. Flynn, tell me if I'm mistaken. The affidavit was created at the specific request of the Essex County Prosecutor's Office. It was not pre-existing. It was created for the purpose of this trial. Am I mistaken about that?
That's correct, Justice.
How does that make a difference? but it was created beforehand when, as I said before, are they supposed to have affidavits as to every citizen in the state? It was created for this particular case. How does that make it violate the rules of evidence? The ones I mentioned before, 803C10 and 807, okay? How does that violate the rules of evidence?
Again, Justice, the rule, even if this doesn't violate the rules of evidence, it still is subject to confrontation if it's the testimonial document.
The rules of evidence provide that it doesn't require, it's admissible, it doesn't require testimony. You could have subpoenaed the officer if you wanted to, but what you suggest is that the rules of evidence do not apply in this situation, that they have to call someone. If that's the case, then we might as well do away with those two rules of evidence that do not require testimony. They're admissible. Is that you're suggesting that we should take those rules out, abolish them?
No, Justice. I mean, in a civil context, there's not a right of confrontation. But this is, the confrontation clause is currently interpreted by the Supreme Court following Crawford, might exclude some reliable documents admissible under state evidence rules without cross-examination because it focuses on the method of production, not the reliability. And the ability to subpoena witnesses or to present evidence in a different form that's close to it doesn't make it admissible under the Constitution.
Mr. Flynn, years ago when this court had to grapple with the statute the legislature passed for production of laboratory certificates prepared by scientists at the state lab, we dealt with a similar problem. And as you know, confrontation clause problems have to be asserted, or otherwise they can be waived, of course. And we reconciled the need to perhaps produce someone every single time with a procedure of requiring the defense or any attorney, any party, to demand production in advance so that the state would have notice to produce the person who spoke to the testimonial part of the document. There, the lab report identifying the type of drugs, here the information about searching the record for defendant. Has your office considered and is it in a position to take a position on a similar notice to produce process here so that someone would not need to be produced each and every time the kind of record that we're focused on here is needed at a trial?
I'm not in a position today to fully agree with a notice and production requirement as has been done in other contexts. I do want to note, though, that this is something that defense counsel sometimes stipulates to the admission of a permit document like this. In a lot of cases, there's like also the main question is whether the defendant actually possessed the gun. It's sometimes an ancillary issue that's not really central to the defense.
Right.
Mr. Flynn, are you perhaps understating that? How often would you say these witnesses are actually brought in and then called to the stand to testify?
I'm an appellate attorney, so I'm probably not the best person to ask for this. But, I mean, like, the colloquial story, when I got this case, I was like, I thought of another case I had where I remembered the name Rep. Bloom, and it turned out that he actually came in a Union County case and offered 5 minutes of testimony authenticating a document just like this. So statewide, I'm really not sure exactly how often this problem is arising. I mean, Melendez-Diaz was decided many years ago, and it's just making its way to this court now. So my inclination is that it's not really that wide of a problem where, you know, defendants aren't stipulating or, but I'm not entirely sure.
And I want to follow up on Justice LaVecchia's earlier question. Have there been problems that your office has noticed with respect to the notice and demand rule that now exists for survey maps?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor. I mean, co-counsel in the next case might be a little bit more aware than I am, but not that I'm aware of.
Can you speak to the holding in State versus Ingram? Is that still good law?
We haven't, in this case, there's no challenge raised to the permissive inference in Ingram, but I would like to make clear that it's not a presumption, which is kind of how the state characterized it in a lot of briefs, because that would be unconstitutional if it was a mandatory presumption, and it would violate due process and diminish the burden of proof. It's a permissive inference that a jury can make that if the defendant doesn't come forward with evidence of a permit, that the defendant lacks that permit. So I can't say that I or anyone below me in this case raised a specific challenge to the constitutionality of that presumption. But I would submit that it is still harmful error in this case, because kind of, as outlined in State v. Martini, the case I cited in the brief, it's a permissive inference. And when the jury is being asked the documents that conclusively establishes the essential element of the offense, it's hard to say beyond, you can't really say that that's a harmless error beyond a reasonable doubt, that there was not a reasonable probability that that document contributed to the jury's decision to convict defendant on the count of charging him with possession of a gun without a permit. There might be a challenge in the future to the constitutionality of that Ingram presumption, but not for each of this case.
Other questions, anyone? Is there anything you'd like to add at this time?
No, Your Honor, I would just respectfully reiterate that both of the errors in this case were harmful. They cannot be declared harmless beyond a reasonable doubt for the reasons outlined in my brief regarding the strength of this case's evidence and the way that this confession was used by the prosecutor in opening the summation to prove that defendant knew that possessed these guns and was involved in the shooting. And because I just reiterated that as to the constitutional position as well. Thank you.
Mr. Munoz.
Good morning, Your Honors. Please, the court. As Mr. Flynn has already articulated, the state has a long history of honoring defendant's privilege against self-incrimination to a far greater level than that required by the U.S. Constitution and the United States Supreme Court cases interpreting the Fifth Amendment. To that end, this court has promulgated various rules and tests intended to provide elevated protections in instances of custodial interrogations. In the Miranda waiver context, these rules focus on one critical issue, and that's ensuring that the defendant's waiver of his rights is knowing, voluntary, and intelligent. To that end, when a defendant invokes or waives his Miranda rights, this court, for instance, requires police officers to issue fresh warnings before attempting to interrogate him again. That's State v. Hartley, 103 NJ, 267. Police also must inform a defendant that when an attorney is present to consult with him. This court has determined that a failure to do so deprives a defendant of knowledge indispensable to knowing an intelligent waiver, and that therefore any subsequent statements must be suppressed. And that's State v. Reed, 133 NJ 248. And again, when police withhold the fact that they have a warrant for a suspect's arrest, any subsequent statements must be suppressed because police are, again, withholding information indispensable to the knowing and intelligent waiver of the defendant's Miranda rights. That's State v. AGD, 178 NJ at 56. In 2007, in State v. O'Neill, this court set forth yet another test to determine the admissibility of statements, this time made in response to a two-step question-first, warn-later interrogation. As in prior Miranda waiver cases, this court again emphasized that the core inquiry was whether defendant's waiver was knowing, voluntary, and intelligent. That is, whether, in the court's words, in the setting of a two-stage interrogation, the Miranda warnings gave the defendant a meaningful opportunity to exercise his rights. This court relied in large part on the principles set forth in the prior three cases I discussed, that the police cannot withhold information necessary for the exercise of the Fifth Amendment privileges. The court was also very clear that the test it set forth in O'Neill was an objective totality of the circumstances test. It's focused on ensuring that the defendant had that necessary information to knowingly waive or invoke his rights. The court intentionally designed this test to avoid what it referred to as the unworkable standard of delving into a police officer's state of mind. So the factors that were set forth under O'Neill have already been discussed by Mr. Flynn, but it bears reiterating that the O'Neill court did put particular emphasis on the fourth factor it listed, which was whether the officers informed the defendant that his pre-warning statements could not be used against him. The court specifically said that under that formula, great weight should be given if police informed a suspect that his admissions made prior to be giving Miranda warnings could not be used against him. The court found that such giving such a retrospective warning would strongly suggest that the defendant made any post-warning statements.
We said great weight should be given to that if the state, if it was actually given. We didn't comment on what weight should be given to that factor if it's not, if they don't say it. Are you following me?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. One doesn't necessarily mean the other. We said if the police advise the defendant, you know that statement that you made earlier, that can't be used against you. That, we said under that circumstance, great weight would be given to it. We didn't say the converse, that great weight will be given to it if you don't give it. Are you following me?
Yes, Your Honor. It's the ACDL's position that the converse is, it would flow from that.
Okay.
It seems a reasonable inference that the converse would be also true.
Let me ask, the O'Neill factors are not necessarily exhaustive. What weight do we give to the court's finding that the police made a threat? They not only didn't give the warnings, but they said, if you don't admit to this, we're going to call it DIFAS. Maybe you'll lose your child. Like, what weight should be given to that factor, and whether or not that bell is unrung 6 hours later when the Miranda warnings are given? Go ahead.
Certainly. I think that the context of the original and the content of the original question, the initial unwarned questioning, that would vary case by case. I mean, regarding the threats, the interactions, how exactly coercive the nature of that initial interrogation was, will vary case by case, and inherently it's going to carry different weight, you know, based on that context. I think what distinguishes the warning issue is that it's in essence a binary. It's a fairly simple inquiry as to whether or not this, you know, the suspect was warned after the fact regarding their prior statements. So it's, I think, a little easier to accord, you know, great weight to that yes or no question, because there isn't as much of a sliding scale depending on the case. As set forth in greater detail in ACDL's brief, since O'Neill was decided, the trial courts have applied the O'Neill test somewhat haphazardly. It's often that the courts don't consider whether a warning was given. And when they do, it's generally not given the weight that is described in O'Neill.
Counsel, you suggested, the organization is suggesting, that an additional warning be given at the end of the traditional Miranda warnings.
That is among the proposals.
My question is, would a warning about what may happen with respect to prior statements possibly confuse the majority of defendants to whom it would not apply? Will it help, or might it actually make things a little bit more complicated for a defendant evaluating whether to waive?
We've considered that, and it seems that although it may confuse the occasional defendant, adding language to that warning that a defendant can confer with counsel, that is something that they can discuss with their lawyer, we think that would go a long ways to resolving any confusion. And certainly we would be happy with an outcome that would encourage more defendants to speak with their lawyers. I don't believe that would, you know, be a particularly problematic for defendants.
So, counsel, in your argument and your assessment of the weighing of the factors, I take it that you would view factors one, the significant break of time, the use of a different detective, the understanding that the second interrogation was not a continuation of the first, without the additional warning of, and that confession you gave earlier won't be used against you, those first three that I mentioned really don't do much to relieve a defendant's fear of having let the cat out of the bag in that earlier interrogation. Is that correct with respect to your position, and that there's synergy added to that by the Dyfus threat, I'll use the word threat, that was raised in the earlier exchange with defendant at the house?
Sure, Your Honor. I think that in this particular case, that's accurate. But I also think that one of the appeals of a presumption would be that it would require trial courts to consider, as a threshold matter, whether or not that retrospective warning was given. And then it's not an irrebuttable presumption. It can be overcome. If there was a significant gap in time, if the agency's
O'Neill went to great lengths to say that we're not establishing some bright-line rules here. This is a totality assessment. Why do you feel the need to push further from what O'Neill has already said on that point?
Based on a review of the available unpublished opinions, it appears that despite O'Neill's guidance that factor should be accorded great weight, many, if not most, trial judges tend to either pay it just glancing service or ignore it entirely.
Mm-hmm. So that, excuse me, depends on your interpretation of that O'Neill factor as being afforded great weight in either direction. Respectfully, I think that the way it's phrased would suggest it's really about the situation where the warning was given. But if that is what O'Neill intended, that it really be, if it was given, that is entitled to great weight. No comment on great weight otherwise. What's your argument for an expansion of O'Neill?
I think, first off, if the ACDL's reading is accurate, and that it is supposed to be given great weight in both directions, that this would encourage courts.
Understood. My question is the opposite. If it isn't, if you're not reading it correctly, if it's not intended to be to have the same effect whether it exists or it doesn't exist, what's your argument for expanding the O'Neill test?
Our argument for expansion is largely predicated on
on your interpretation of that fourth factor.
Okay.
Thank you.
But we have your case before us, and I'm assuming without expanding O'Neill and using the factors, you're saying a totality review would lead to suppression, correct?
And on these
that was my point exactly. Oh, too.
I apologize, Justice.
Right?
Correct.
You're here as amicus today, so we're asking you for guidance generally, mm-hmm. not to defend or decide this particular set of facts for us, right?
Yeah.
Certainly.
The reason why I asked that question, just to be clear, is if you think that the result you believe should be achieved, can be achieved under the present test, like, why is there a need for an expansion? That's the reason why I asked the question.
It would appear that lower courts, again, if the ACDL's reading of O'Neill is correct, it would appear that lower courts need some additional guidance as to whether they should consider that factor.
And if it's not, then what you say, and I don't know what opinions, unpublished opinions you're referring to, but what your comment is on the unpublished opinion showing not enough weight being given to that fourth factor, if you're wrong about your interpretation, that's not something we should be concerned with. Am I right about that?
I think we would argue that
You're going to argue you're right, but if we don't agree, that argument based upon a problem existing out there in our courts would go away. Is that correct?
Thank you. Anything else you'd like to add?
I would just conclude with the request that or adopt the proposed presumption set forth in our brief. And thank you. Yes, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Munoz. Ms. Rosencrantz.
Well, judges, first of all, I'm sort of having a lot of difficulty hearing from the questions from the court, so
we'll try to speak up.
Have to bear with me.
We'll try to speak up.
Okay. As for the opening statement, this was not a traditional two-step interrogation because James, who took the warrant statement, didn't know of the unwarranted statement. Thus, he couldn't have exploited it to force a confession out of defendant. Three children were there when defendant was arrested. Drugs were in the apartment, and the police didn't know if defendant's wife was involved. Given this, the trial court found that the officer was telling the truth when he told defendant that his children may have to be taken into Dyfus custody. In any event, the trial court gave the defendant the benefit of the doubt and suppressed defendant's statement, unwarranted statement, that the drugs and gun were his. Besides that, though, the warrant statement clearly wasn't tainted by the unwarranted statement. 6 hours had passed between the statements given at different locations. James had no prior involvement in the investigation. James, again, had no inkling of the unwarranted statement, so no wonder he didn't tell defendant it couldn't be used against him. Also, this defendant was 36 years old. He had 2 years of college, and he was no stranger to the criminal justice system, having one prior conviction. The cannot-be-used factor in O'Neill is not talismanic, trumping all other taint factors. It is only one of many taint factors courts consider. Defendant proposes two sanctions for police's not complying with the cannot-be-used factor. Presumed suppression of the warrant statement, and also suppression if the police do not tell defendant before he gives the statement that the unwarranted statement cannot be used against him. Both of these sanctions are draconian, as they bar the jury from considering competent evidence, as well as impractical. They put the officer in this terrible position of deciding at the time whether the unwarranted statement is admissible. That's the judge's job. Also, courts are used to and very well equipped to do the balancing test, like the O'Neill test, to assess taint. Admission of the no permit affidavit was consistent with the confrontation clause. The affidavit only strengthened a presumption the jury was already allowed to make, that defendant didn't have a permit unless he showed to the contrary. Also, the affidavit was non-testimonial. The permit mandates are there to assure that a person is qualified to carry or purchase. They are not manufactured for use at later trial. The affidavit conveys existing information that was created before defendant committed the crime. The trooper doesn't interpret or analyze any information, and no one person is targeted at the time the information is collected. As for the case of Diaz, that allows for evidence of the absence of a public record. Melendez-Diaz comments about certificates of no record or dicta. In that case, the certificates that the tested substances were drugs were created by the testing of the chemist for the sole purpose of trial. Here, as in the Murphy case out of Maine, we are dealing with information that is routinely maintained in public records before trial and not secured by a person's analysis of that information. Defendant is just insisting on cross-examination for its own sake. Also, very briefly, error, if any, in admitting either the statement or the affidavit was harmless. As to the statement, the jury still would have considered the drugs that were recovered and the gun, which matched the projectile found at the shooting scene. Also, defendant didn't fear the wrath of the police. He gave a soft-pedaling statement where he blamed someone else for shooting Mr. Rivera, and he claimed that the gun was for self-protection and the drugs were for his own use. As to the affidavit, defendant admitted to having the unlicensed gun. Also, the permit issue wasn't hotly contested at trial. Counsel portrayed Rivera as an incredible drug addict and convicted felon, lampooned the single photo ID, and highlighted that the projectile wasn't recovered during the first search. Thank you very much.
As to the affidavit where you just ended, is State versus Ingram and the holding in State versus Ingram still good law?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, the holding of Melendez?
Ingram. State versus Ingram.
Yes.
Is that still good law?
I believe it is, Your Honor. It's still good law. That presumption survives. It's a situation, unlike other situations, it's a situation where a defendant would have unique knowledge that he has the permit to purchase or carry. He would have that information.
But, counsel,
and it just makes sense that the defendant wouldn't play a game with the court, and he could just show the court the license outside the presence of the jury. He doesn't take any testimonial risk.
Counsel, have we not said repeatedly that you cannot place a presumption on the defendant concerning an element of the offense? Even when there is a statutory presumption, it must be read as an inference, a permissive inference, not as a presumption. Am I correct?
Well, that's correct. And here, the trial court did tell the jury that basically they could just presume, make that presumption. They weren't bound by that finding, of course. The jury is always free to reject that presumption.
Am I correct that your office asked for the production of the affidavit?
The presumption of?
Your office asked for the presumption of the affidavit.
Oh, yes. Okay. Yes. And yeah, as I said, the trial court did instruct the jury. I don't have the transcript with me, but I believe right in line with the model jury charge that it was permissive. The jury wasn't bound by it.
Do you have the affidavit in your record? The affidavit.
Your Honor, unfortunately, I don't think it was made part of the record by either party. Yeah. I could double check.
Isn't one of the problems of not having a witness on the stand is that the jury didn't know precisely what information was placed in the database, whatever that database might have been?
Well, Your Honor, the affidavit simply says that the trooper either himself or had someone under his direction look at all the permit records, and there was no indication that this defendant had either a permit to purchase or carry.
Forget about Mr. Carrion. There are people in the database with the same names. Would you agree that there may be John Jones and a number of John Joneses, and you won't know which John Jones unless the appropriate birth date, Social Security number, and other identifying information is placed in. Correct?
Well, Your Honor, I don't believe that the affidavit discloses that type of information.
That's the point. The point I'm making is that without a witness on the stand, that is the type of inquiry that is denied to the defendant. And that's the reason why it's testimonial. It's testimonial because it's proving an element of the crime.
Well, Your Honor, I believe that in that case, the state would have an obligation to provide in prior to trial information as to the information the trooper inputted then. If the defense does raise a question about the reliability of the affidavit, then I believe, yes, the state would have an obligation to provide that information to the defense. And if there's still a problem, then at that point, yes, the trooper would have to testify. But I believe that the defense would have to point to some type of question about the reliability of the affidavit before that would have to happen. And also remember, and this is a type of information that the defendant would know. I mean, he would know whether he has a license or not. So, for example, say the defense does think there is a problem, and the defendant tells his attorney, well, I applied for a license. I don't understand why this affidavit comes back that I don't have a permit. Then the defense counsel could, of course, press the prosecutor for information about that.
Other questions, anyone? Is there anything else you'd like to add?
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Ms. Schwartz.
Good morning, it may please the court. The facts of this case invite this court to revisit the factors of State v. O'Neill and the applicability of factor four. The Attorney General's office indicates that that factor should only be applicable in statements that are not already voluntary under the totality of the circumstances and the other three, other four O'Neill factors. When a statement is truly voluntary, that factor should not be used, as Amicus suggests, to find a statement that not admissible. We're looking at the other factors. They are the same factors that were delineated by this United States Supreme Court in Siebert as factors that look at the circumstances of the statement and do not require police to make preliminary legal conclusions that they are not equipped to make. Factor four.
So you're suggesting factor four can only be used against the defendant, but not in the defendant's favor?
No, Your Honor. We're actually saying that factor four should be used in instances where there wasn't a significant change in time or there wasn't a change in personnel or a change in location, but a warning, as factor four delineates, would actually indicate that a defendant did have their meaningful opportunity to exercise their rights. So if we're looking at the other factors, and there was a significant break in time, as there was here 6 hours, an uninvolved detective who wasn't even aware that a prior statement was made, a change in location, and those factors were not met, but the police officers in that instance give a warning, such as factor four, saying that any prior statement could not be used, that would be a factor that should be looked at in finding those statements voluntary as a cure to any taint. But when we have the other factors that are clearly met and defendant's statement was purely voluntary, that factor four shouldn't be used as a sword to find those voluntary statements involuntary.
Counsel, the key question is whether or not the post-warning statements function effectively in providing the defendant the ability to exercise his state law privilege, correct? In a case such as this, where not only was the defendant not warned and made a confession, but in addition to that was threatened that if he didn't implicate himself, that Dyfus would be called and perhaps he would lose his child. Is that not an aggravating factor in that it's unlikely that the defendant, who remains in custody over 6 hours, no access to an attorney, is still going to have that in his mind, even when he gets the new warnings? Is that fair to say?
Yeah, we disagree with the finding fact that the trial judge here made a finding that there was threats made. The trial judge found that there was some, gave the defendant a benefit of the doubt finding that there was some comment about DC and DCPMP made, and in fact noted that such statement was probably warranted given the situation of three kids in an apartment with guns and drugs and needing to figure out if the wife was involved in the safety of the children, and that statement did trigger Miranda warnings, and the remedy for that error was the inadmissibility finding of that statement. However, when we're looking at defendant's statement 6 hours later, and yes, it was in a holding cell, but he wasn't interrogated by the police, he wasn't contacted by the police, he was allowed that time by himself, not being questioned, unlike the defendant in O'Neill and defendant in Siebert, where they were exclusively questioned in a holding cell, and not their rights not being honored. He was interviewed by a police officer who didn't even know that his prior statement could be made, so a warning such as that couldn't have been.
So does that really make a difference? How much of a difference does that make? So some other officer is questioning him on the same subject, but he knows that he has already admitted to the offense of possession of the gun. The fact that someone else is questioning him is not going to change his state of mind that the cat is out of the bag. Or if you accept that there was a previous threat, that he had been previously threatened. Do you agree?
Well, the trial court found that he was calm and agreed that he was not coerced or threatened during the statement. And I think it does matter that Detective James had no knowledge, because if you look at Siebert, if you look at O'Neill, that O'Neill was trying to protect against these question first, warn later tactics. That's not what we have here. We have an on-the-scene questioning of defendant about the possession of the pouch. And then later on in that interview with Detective James, it's not referred to, it doesn't go back to, it's not used about against him, it's not referred to. And Siebert or O'Neill, everything about the criminality of the events was talked about in those pre-Miranda statements.
Just to be clear, counsel, there was no, tell me if I'm wrong, there was no trial court finding that there was a threat made.
Correct.
There was a trial court finding, if you call it a finding, because it's couched as benefit of the doubt, that a statement about DIFAS was made, now right. DCPP, but DIFAS is apparently the term that was being used. And the trial court even noted that there may have been a need for such a statement. But in terms of, there's all this discussion about assuming that a threat was made, and it seems to me probably based on the idea that there was a trial court finding to that effect, but there was no such finding. Am I correct?
Yes, Your Honor. There was no finding that a threat was made. There was a finding that some statement about calling DCPMP or DIFAS was made, and that such statement was probably warranted given the scenarios of the on the scene.
Yeah, I'm not suggesting that this transcript is clear. I mean, but in the trial court's finding, he did say, however, Ms. Gonzalez and Mr. V testified differently about the specifics. They did testify consistently that they overheard, that they heard the officers indicate that they would need to call DIFAS, DCPP, actually some, they heard DIFAS. And then he goes down, and he refers to this as an inquiry, and he, I'm quoting, I am going to give the defendant the benefit of the doubt, having had two witnesses who testified that they did hear some inquiry. And apparently he's referring back to that. Am I mistaken?
No, Your Honor. The trial court judge gave the defendant the benefit of the doubt that some kind of statement was made and quoted the testimony that was provided, but did go on to recognize that statement was probably warranted given the facts of the situation.
And the word inquiry suggests that they were going to find out, or if they were going to do something possibly about DCPP.
Correct. Note that this wasn't a cat out of the bag situation. The only admission defendant made in the apartment was that the pouch that was found next to him on the sofa bed was him. During his statement to Detective James, he maintained his innocence in the shooting and any involvement in the shooting other than being present. It wasn't the situation in Siebert or O'Neill when the entire element of
what was in the pouch? It was a gun and drugs, correct?
Correct.
Okay. And they asked him if he owned that?
Correct.
Okay. So they were asking if he owned the gun and the drugs, correct?
Correct.
And then they asked him in the second questioning whether or not the gun was his, correct?
Detective James referred to what was found in your possession during your arrest, because the reason why it wasn't the cat out of the bag situation was that that pouch was found sitting next to the defendant on the sofa bed where he was found, and the trial court found that was in plain sight and within defendant.
I'm not asking you about the Fourth Amendment. I'm asking you about what he admitted to.
Yes.
In response to the questions by the police. So in his house, in response to the question, unwarned, he admitted to the gun and the drugs, correct?
According to Detective Maldonado's testimony, he admitted that it was his unprompted, but yes, he admitted that the pouch was his.
And he admitted later, 6 hours later, while he was still in custody, in response to police questioning, that he was the owner of the gun and the drugs, correct?
Correct. However, he was still able to maintain his innocence in the involvement in the shooting, and it wasn't the entirety of the criminality of the event in which he had no quote-unquote backpedaling to available to him. Also, during the statement, he never referred to his wife or his children, and Judge Rosario found that he was calm and collected and voluntarily made that statement to police officers.
But in effect, he admitted to what he had admitted to in the first statement and not more.
Correct. However, unlike in Siebert and O'Neill, there was no reference back. It wasn't like, you previously admitted this. There's no call back to his unwarranted statement. It was just, during your arrest, you were discovered with this. Not, you admitted to this already and trapped him in admitting to it again.
You're not suggesting that in 6 hours he forgot what he told the police officers earlier?
No, Your Honor. I just call this court's attention to the Ross case out of the Florida Supreme Court, where they, following the confusion in the federal jurisprudence similar to this court in O'Neill, factored a test that looked at both the police's behavior and the circumstances of both statements. And without requiring police to make a preliminary legal decision, determination, and pass it on to defendants, looks at whether or not the police used that earlier statement and created a continuum of events, if they used delayed tactics, if they referred back to. Therefore, it eliminates any police inappropriate behavior of police without requiring them to make such legal conclusion as when did custodial interrogation begin. Similarly, in Elstead, the defendant made a similar argument here, saying that without this warning, they couldn't have made a voluntary statement. But the Supreme Court rejected such arguments, saying that Miranda warnings themselves inform a defendant that they could talk to counsel and that police officers are not pinch hitters for such counsel, and that such requirement is not voluntary, not constitutionally required. Also in Elstead, they said that even if a statement was found to be actually coerced, and a significant break in time and place and police personnel would help to remove that taint. So if we're looking at the facts here where there is no clear finding of coercion and we have this huge break in time and place and personnel, it's clear that defendant's statement was here was voluntary. If there's no further questions on the Miranda issue, I'll turn to the gun permit affidavit. The affidavit here was not testimonial. Unlike the defendant's reliance on Melendez-Diaz, which talked about certificates of no record, that was purely in dicta. And this court, while it's persuasive, is not bound to such interpretation. The actual affidavit found to be testimonial in Melendez-Diaz was a forensic scientist's testing of drug evidence and required specialized knowledge and methodology and did not exist independent to prosecution. The gun database here existed outside of prosecution and is kept for public safety records. It was just a mere transcription of what already existed into a document, and such is not testimonial.
So the argument that you heard counsel make was, we object to the part of the affidavit that says, I searched and I didn't find the defendant's name. Why is that not a problem under the Confrontation Clause?
If you look at the reasoning in Murphy from the Maine Supreme Court, which we find persuasive, when we're looking at like the affidavit in Melendez-Diaz, we're looking at something that requires specialized knowledge and interpretation, and the defendant can needs to be able to cross-examine a person on their knowledge, their speciality, their methods used. Here, it's searching of a database that is a public kept database. It's not the same type of questioning and beneficial information that would come out of cross-examination here.
Why not? And when I say why not, the information that is inputted into the database is important in terms of what you get out, correct?
Correct.
From just the affidavit, without having a witness on the stand, how do you know that the right birth date was put in, the right social security number, the right identification number, or that the officer used the appropriate database? How would you know that just from the affidavit without a witness on the stand?
With all due respect, Your Honor, those types of questioning is not going to produce any beneficial liability questioning, because the officer that's going to testify that they searched the records correctly and the affidavit says
that. How do you know? That's the reason why we put witnesses on the stand. The lack of a permit is an element of the offense. You've got to prove it, correct?
Correct.
So why doesn't, if it's testimonial, that is, it's incriminating, it's proving the element of an offense, why doesn't the state, the defendant, if he's not stipulating to it, have a right to question someone about how the information was extracted from the database and whether or not the right information was extracted?
While the Attorney General's office agrees that there are questions that can be asked that might adduce information, that does not make it testimonial and give the defendant the right to that questioning. The information here was not did not exist for a prosecution. It existed before a prosecution.
Is the affidavit not being offered to prove an element of the offense?
It is, Your Honor.
Okay, that's incriminating. That's not testimonial.
We're maintaining that the reasoning behind the Virginia case in Harris, although it predates Melendez-Diaz and Murphy, is persuasive, and that this type of information itself is not testimonial in nature because of how it existed prior to prosecution.
Anything else you'd like to add?
No, just that the Attorney General office asked this court to affirm the appellate decision.
Can I ask one question, Chief? Because I think it was touched on by other counsel. The presumption contained in 2C39-2, and the Chief previously referred to Ingram, is it the state's contention that the affidavit was not necessary to establish possession without a permit?
The Attorney General office didn't make the same argument with respect to the state in that, but I believe the state's position was that it was just additional, that with that permissive inference that the defendant should have produced the permit if it existed, and that this affidavit was just cumulative evidence of that.
So that even if no affidavit was produced, even if it violated the Confrontation Clause, the contention is that the presumption gets that element of the offense to a jury.
Correct, Your Honor.
But I know we're using the term presumption, and that you've used it as a permissive inference.
Correct.
Do you know of any case where the state has prosecuted a person for a carrying permit violation without introducing an affidavit or a witness as proof that the person didn't have a permit?
I'm not aware.
Thank you.
Thank
counsel.
You.
Mr. Flynn, brief rebuttal.
I'll respectfully waive rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you to counsel. We'll take the matter under